everyone. I'm Sam.
And I'm Sean.
And this is Key the Case. Welcome back. Thank you all for joining us for our 100th episode.
Woo!
I can't believe we reached 100 episodes. It feels like such an accomplishment. And we really could not have made it this far without all of you who continue to tune in for every case. It was difficult to decide which case to cover for this episode, and I finally chose one. And as I was about to start working on it, I learned there were arrests for the alleged murder of that victim. His body has not been found, but it's presumed he was murdered. So I decided to switch gears and instead cover one of our most highly recommended cases. So thank you to everyone who has suggested we cover the death of Hugues de la Plaza. Just a quick warning that today's case will bring up the discussion of suicide. Let's get into it. Hugues de la Plaza was 36 years old at the time of his death in 2007. Hugues was born in France in 1971 and was an only child to two parents who doted on him. Hugues had an adventurous spirit and, as an adult, decided he wanted to travel as much as possible. So in 1998, about 9 years before his death, he immigrated to the United States, settling in New York. He loved it enough to choose to stay and pursue citizenship, which he ultimately obtained. About 4 years before Hugues' death, he left New York and moved to San Francisco, California, where he worked as an audio engineer. At the time of his death, he was working for Leapfrog, the educational toy and software company, and had recently been promoted. Those closest to Hugues described him as being very social, smart, open-minded, and having a good heart. They also explained that there was no one quite like Hugues. He had this charm and charisma that oftentimes drew people to him. He'd had a brief marriage that did not work out, and once he moved to the U.S., he and a woman named Melissa met, and they had a pretty instant connection. The pair began dating and remained together for about 4 years. Melissa has said Hugues really challenged and stimulated her, and although their relationship didn't work out, they maintained a friendship. The year before Hugues died, 2006, Melissa saw him for the first time since they'd broken up, and they had actually been considering getting back together. It seemed that neither of them had really moved on, but Melissa reported that he had changed a little bit. It seemed like he was drinking slightly more than he had been when they were dating, and it just wasn't the right time for them to get back together. And Hugues was also really living the bachelor life, dating a lot of different women. In an interview with 48 Hours, one of Hugues' friends divulged that he didn't use a lot of discretion when it came to who he was dating, specifically meaning he did not care if a woman he began seeing was married or in a relationship. It was like not even a consideration for him. He met women out at bars, but also online through dating websites. When Hugues died, he had been living in Hayes Valley, a neighborhood in San Francisco, and he loved the area. Melissa shared that it had a special place in his heart, and he liked that it was charming, but a little bit edgy at the same time. Overall, Hugues had a rich life. He loved to learn, very into philosophy. He often took rides on his motorcycle, spent nights out with his friends, and looked for ways to use his creativity, whether that be through his work as a sound engineer or through something like art or music. Friday, June 1st, 2007 began as an ordinary day. Hugues rode his motorcycle to work, and he and one of his coworkers, Neil, who was also a good friend, shared lunch and played pool before returning to work. Now, it came as a surprise to no one that Hugues had a date planned that night. He met up with a French woman he'd met online around 6 p.m. They chatted over a couple of glasses of wine at a place down the street from his apartment and went their separate ways afterward because she had other plans and Hugues ended up with other plans, which we'll get into in a second. But according to a French article about this case, it sounded like his plans were more impromptu and hers were prearranged. Ook called around to a few friends and eventually planned to meet up at a nightclub with Neil, his coworker and friend whom he'd had lunch with that day, as well as a few other friends and coworkers. Ook got to the nightclub, Underground SF, around 10:30 p.m. When he arrived, he told his friends that the date earlier in the night was sort of a flop, indicating that he and the woman he saw would just be friends. The San Francisco Chronicle reported that, according to his friends, Ook was in good spirits that night, enjoying himself, having a few drinks, and chatting with several women. Ook and his friends stayed until the club closed at 2 a.m., and 48 Hours reported that on his way out, Ook joked that he was going to go find a woman to sleep with. One of the French articles about this case indicated that Ook's friend Neil asked him, you know, as he was leaving, if he wanted to go get pizza with him and his girlfriend, to which Ook declined, but asked if Neil knew where he could find any cocaine. I didn't read that piece anywhere else, but reportedly Ook used cocaine on occasion and Neil did not know where he could find any. However, they made plans to meet up the next day, or I guess it was later that day since it was 2 a.m., so they made plans to go on a motorcycle ride together. As they parted ways, he also told Neil that he might meet up with a woman he had met on a prior occasion, but we know that Ook did not meet up with her or anyone, so clearly that didn't work out. Ook walked home from the club, a walk that only took around 5 minutes because the nightclub was only about 0.6 miles from his home. One report indicated that Ook made a call to a friend to see if he wanted to see a movie the next day. The friend said Ook sounded a little drunk on the phone, but he didn't say anything that stood out. So if you're keeping track, he now had plans to see a movie and go on a motorcycle ride later that day. Reportedly, Ook's final phone call was around 2:15 a.m. to a different friend. He was inquiring with this friend about a woman he might be with. Essentially, he thought this friend was with two women, and apparently he wanted to get with one of them, but his friend said he was no longer with both of them. It was later established that when Ook got home, he spent time on his laptop, on some dating and adult websites, and Craigslist. We also know he prepared peas and rice as a snack or meal. When he got to his apartment, it was shortly after 2 a.m. Then, around 2:40 a.m., some of Ook's neighbors were awoken by strange noises. And Ook lived in what was described as a triplex, so he shared walls with people, and their front doors were all directly next to each other outside, mere inches apart. So we're talking about pretty close quarters here. And we will have a photo of this on our Instagram as well as other photos. So I recommend checking it out over at Key to the Case podcast. One of Ook's neighbors who he shared walls with told the San Francisco Chronicle that a loud thud woke him around 2:40 a.m. He then heard what he believed was Ook's front door open and close a few minutes after that noise, and then heard footsteps running down the stairs outside because there were several steps to get up to their front doors. And he believed he heard Ook's door open and close for a third and final time, then more footsteps, someone walking around Ook's apartment followed by a final thud. He did not hear any sort of yelling or a verbal exchange. So at that point, he didn't know what he had just heard, really, but he didn't think it was a struggle or fight. And it all happened in the matter of a couple of minutes. So he went back to sleep.
But he assumed it was an interaction with another person of some sort.
He never said that. The neighbor did not describe it that way. He didn't really know what he was hearing. So I don't know that he made that assumption.
Yeah, I suppose the way it was described, it sounded like there were two separate people within all of these sounds, like the door opening and closing and the footsteps walking away and then the door opening and closing again. It sounded like there'd have to be multiple people.
I I mean, it does sound like that. Yeah, he just didn't hear any sort any people talking to each other, yelling at each other. So he was also half asleep during all of this. So we have to keep in mind that maybe some of what he heard was a little bit out of order or slightly misremembered, right? But there was another neighbor. So the other person or couple, I believe, who lived in the triplex, they also remembered hearing a door, presumably Oog's door, open and close a few times after Oog arrived home that night. Later that morning at 8:30, one of Oog's neighbors was startled to find a bloody scene outside their front doors. Like I said, there were several steps to get up to the landing where their front doors were, and there was a pool of blood on the landing outside and kind of on the top step, as well as blood on the railing going up the stairs and on Oog's doorknob. Immediately knowing something was wrong, this neighbor called 911. When the San Francisco police arrived, they got no response when they knocked on Oog's door and found that his front door was locked and deadbolted. They then went to the back of his home where the other entry point was, and that door was locked as well. Now, I've seen some discrepancies about this back door. According to some reports, and I believe this came from the police, the back door was deadbolted, meaning someone couldn't have locked it on their way out unless they had a key. So either someone locked these doors from the inside or someone locked them with a key on their way out. However, Melissa, Oog's ex-girlfriend, has disputed this, saying that the back door could have been locked just from the knob. And 48 Hours covered this case, and during that coverage, they displayed a photo of the back door, and it did not appear to have a deadbolt. So I don't know why it was reported that both doors were locked that way. And this was kind of made out to be a big deal, but I actually don't think this is as big of a deal as people make it out to be. And I'll explain that more here shortly. The police peered inside Oog's home through a kitchen window and saw blood, at which point they decided to break down one of Oog's doors to enter his home. Inside, they found Oog lying on his living room floor, deceased and covered in blood. There was blood tracked throughout Oog's home, blood tracked from the front door area to the kitchen and living room. It appeared as though Oog had walked around his home while bleeding, touching various objects, including doorknobs, light switches, and his laptop, which was open on the coffee table before collapsing where he was found. There were bloody handprints and smears going down the wall next to his body. So it's believed that he was sort of grabbing at the wall as he fell down. Additionally, his TV was found on the floor, as well as a broken wine glass. The investigators found Oog's watch lying underneath his body, and it had been crushed. The medical examiner, Dr. Venus Azar, who would later conduct Oog's autopsy, visited the scene and initially thought it looked like there had been a struggle leading up to Oog's death and that this was a homicide. She noted that Oog's cell phone was sitting on his coffee table by his laptop. And like I said, the laptop had blood on it, but the phone did not. And we know that Oog did not attempt to call for help with his phone. So it appeared he didn't touch it at all. There was a cord plugged into Oog's laptop, and it looked as though that cord had been ripped from the wall. So to my knowledge, it's very possible Oog tripped over that cord as he was presumably stumbling through the living room. I also think it's possible he knocked over the TV and broke the wine glass, and we'll get into that more later, meaning what could have played out here. There are a few possibilities, but Dr. Azar needed to determine how Oog died. It looked like he may have been stabbed. There was no bloody knife or other weapon, for that matter, around his body or in his home. So the assumption would be that someone else did this to him. It was established that Oog was stabbed 3 times on the left side of his body, in the neck, chest, and stomach. Dr. Azar reported that the wound to his neck went from right to left and downward. The wound in his chest went right to left and downward, and the wound in his stomach went straight in. Now, the wound to the left base of Oog's neck was the most severe. It penetrated his left lung and transected a large vein and artery beneath his collarbone. This injury was most likely the source of a significant amount of blood at Oog's home. And after sustaining it, he would have only had 1 to 2 minutes to survive.
Did Oog have any defensive wounds? Did it appear that he was trying to defend himself at all?
He had some other injuries besides what I just described that could be considered defensive wounds, including a few blunt force injuries. And then there were some small abrasions to his forehead, lip, and arm. There was a minor sharp force injury to the left side of his forehead. It was 5/8 of an inch wide and had a depth of only about 1/8 of an inch. So it was almost as though he had kind of been nicked with the knife, assuming a knife was used here. Then he had about a 2-inch bruise on the front of his right forearm. And Dr. Azar told 48 Hours that these injuries could be considered defensive wounds.
Could they have also occurred as he was stumbling around and falling down?
I suppose, yeah. I think either situation would be possible. We don't know exactly how the last minutes of his life played out. So it is possible that he sustained additional injuries there. And she seems surprised not to have found more defensive wounds because Oog was a healthy person in his 30s and he was also a black belt in karate. So maybe there's a case to be made there that there should have been more. So determining the cause of death was pretty straightforward, multiple stab wounds, but the manner of death proved to be more difficult. According to Dr. Azar, the stab wounds were not inconsistent with being self-inflicted. They were also not inconsistent with being inflicted by another person. And despite a bloody knife not being found in Oog's home, Dr. Azar felt that she could not definitively say that this was a homicide or suicide. She believed it could have been either, so she ruled the manner of death as undetermined.
With the stab wounds, were they able to determine like the level of severity between the three? If they were self-inflicted, obviously the first one would probably be the most severe and reach the deepest. And then from there, you know, the second would be a little less impactful, and then the last one being the least.
I see what you mean. You're saying like as he's losing blood, yeah, he wouldn't be able to...
He'd lose a little bit of strength.
Yes.
With each stab wound.
So, good question. The depth of all of these wounds were about the same. They were all approximately 3 inches.
Yeah, you'd think after you mentioned that first one, he'd have only a minute or two due to how much blood he was losing based on that first stab wound. You'd think he'd lose a significant amount of strength to be able to stab as deep as he did the first one.
Well, we actually don't know the order in which the stab wounds occurred. We just know that the one around his neck was the most severe. It makes... I think your point still stands that how would he with any of these sustain like the same amount of strength to go like exactly the same depth? It seems a little easier to understand that someone else inflicting these upon him would like basically insert the knife with consistency.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was getting at.
And there was more that went into Dr. Azar's decision other than the injuries, as we'll discuss. There's a lot to get into here, guys. But before we move on from the injuries, I just want to add that the superficial wound to Oog's forehead feels significant because if he turned a knife on himself, it's a little more difficult to make sense of a tiny cut on his forehead. Whereas it's easy to envision how if someone began attacking him with a knife, he could have been nicked, like I said, during that. The bruise could be significant too. But I suppose you could say, well, maybe he had that before his death, but he probably received that sharp force abrasion to his forehead during his death. Dr. Czar told 48 Hours that the first mention of suicide came from Melissa, Oog's ex-girlfriend, when she initially spoke with the lead investigator from the San Francisco PD, Detective Casillas. According to Casillas, Melissa said to him during the conversation, "Can I ask you one thing? Was this harakiri? Did he go into his stomach?" Oog was very interested in Japanese culture, and harakiri refers to a traditional form of ritual suicide involving disembowelment with a sword, historically practiced by Japanese samurai as an honorable alternative to disgrace or execution.
Yeah, I find the suicide notion a little far-fetched. He was making all sorts of plans with his friends that day to go, you know, like you said, on a motorcycle ride and go see a movie. Like, and that night he was in very high spirits. And I mean, obviously you can't be in the mind of someone. And, you know, when they decide to do that, it appeared as though he was in a good frame of mind.
What do you think specifically about the harakiri aspect here and her questioning that?
Yeah. When you mentioned that he was pretty into Japanese culture, I was assuming you meant like anime and Japanese food and, you know, things along those lines. It seems somewhat of a leap to go directly to how samurais would commit suicide and place that onto Oog. It seems a bit of a reach.
Yeah, it just seemed like a big jump to go from he was interested in Japanese culture and samurai movies to he did this to himself. Apparently, that's what Melissa was wondering. But Melissa has claimed that Detective Casillas' questions and statements were very suggestive of suicide. So she felt like she was being led in that direction, not knowing the entirety of the circumstances of his death yet. So she could have been, you know, taking that information in and just trying to come up with something that would make sense in her mind. Casillas denies this, saying, if he wanted to ask if Oog could have died by suicide, he knows how to ask those questions. And during Melissa's interview with Casillas, she indicated that at one point in the past, she was concerned about Oog and asked him if he was thinking of harming himself, but he completely denied this. When Casillas asked what prompted her to ask that, she explained that it was just her intuition. Ultimately, Melissa was outraged that her statements seemed to carry so much weight because, one, she said she was speculating based on what was suggested to be a suicide, and two, the last time she saw Oog was 6 months before his death, and it had been years since they had been in a relationship, so she felt that she was not the right person to speak to Oog's present state of mind. Oog's friend Neil, who he went out with the night of Oog's death, indicated that he couldn't get a hold of Casillas or anyone to talk with him from the police in the few days after Oog's death. He was one of the last people to see Oog alive. You'd think he'd be one of the first people they'd speak with, but he couldn't get in contact with anyone for a while. But when he finally spoke with Detective Casillas, Casillas allegedly asked Neil if Oog was right or left-handed and inquired about his apparent obsession, as he called it, with Japan. And Neil said he hoped he wasn't suggesting that Oog killed himself. Now, they later determined Oog was right-handed and the injuries were consistent with being inflicted by someone who was right-handed, whether it be him or someone else. According to San Francisco Weekly, friends and neighbors said investigators largely focused their questions on Oog's mental state, asking whether he was depressed, used drugs, wrote poetry, or appeared to be struggling internally. And I think most of us can agree that it's okay to ask those questions, but if the police weren't also asking, was there anyone who could have wanted to harm him? Do we know anything about the people he was dating? Did the neighbors see anyone suspicious around Oog's home before his death? You know, questions like that, it does become a bit leading. And this does support what Melissa said about how they were being suggested that this was a suicide. Many of Oog's friends told the investigators about how he was actively looking to buy property in Argentina in the next few months. He had just been promoted, just bought a new laptop, seemed to be looking to the future. Although we tend not to focus too much on details like that in a case like this. You mentioned it. You can't get into someone's head, right? Someone can do all of that and still die by suicide. On the other hand, Dr. Azar told the media that Oog had undergone certain behavioral changes before he died, including missing appointments and spending money frivolously.
Were they able to find any type of suicide note? Did he have one written down, or did he send an email or a text or anything like that?
There was no suicide note anywhere, or suicide was not mentioned in an email or a text or anything. Now, there was a piece of paper or a notepad next to Oog's laptop on the coffee table that said, "Learn as if you were to live forever and live as if you were to die tomorrow." If you look at this case from the suicide angle, sure, you could say maybe he wrote that right before his death, but we actually don't know when he wrote that. There was no blood on it, so we just know definitely not after he was stabbed. And it feels more motivational to me, like being aware of your mortality and using that to inform how you live your life.
Yeah, that seems like the opposite of what you would write if you were to commit suicide. That appears to be a motivational quote, like you were saying, to live your life to the fullest.
And Oog was into philosophy. Like, it just does not seem that unusual for that to be written down in his home. And like I said, he could have written that days ago, weeks ago. We don't know, right? It was just in a notepad or on a piece of paper. The San Francisco Chronicle reported that, according to friends and family, the investigators suggested to them that Oog had taken drugs at the nightclub, returned home, and stabbed himself 3 times. However, the toxicology report contradicted this theory. No drugs were found in Oog's system other than alcohol, and his blood alcohol concentration was modest at 0.11, which is a little higher than the legal driving limit. And that aligned with how much people recalled him drinking at the club. It's possible, though, that he even continued to drink a little bit after he arrived home, but we can't say that with certainty. His stomach contents contained just over 3 ounces of material, including peas, indicating that Oog had at least briefly begun to eat. The dinner plate in his home was consistent with this because, if you recall, there was that plate in the kitchen with only partially eaten rice and peas. So he was either interrupted while he was eating or decided he didn't want to eat anymore and began stabbing himself. Regardless, the alleged theory that Oog killed himself while under the influence of drugs went out the window. During the analysis of the scene in Oog's home, they could not find evidence that someone else had been present inside during Oog's death. There were some shoe prints in the blood inside his home, and those were consistent with the shoes Oog was wearing when the police found him. There were no unidentified shoe prints in the blood, but there were also no shoe prints in the blood that was outside of Oog's home on the landing and stairs. And this is significant because the suicide theory in this case is that essentially Oog stabbed himself inside his home, walked around, and then walked outside for some reason, stood outside for a little bit, and then walked back inside before dying.
So if that's how this happened, then with the amount of blood he's losing, there should be shoe prints outside, his shoe prints.
Exactly. How is it that if that's what happened, he left no shoe prints outside? In that scenario, like you said, he was already bleeding a lot. You'd think he'd leave a blood trail on his way out, and then there was a specific spot on the landing where a lot of blood was concentrated. So with this theory, he probably stopped in that position and then went back inside. You'd think somewhere along the way back inside, since he was already bleeding when he stepped out, he would have left shoe prints in the blood, and you'd expect 2 trails of blood, one when he walked out and one when he walked back in, instead of the 1 trail that was present. This could easily be explained by Oog having been attacked on the landing outside. Maybe someone knocked on his door, got him to come outside a little bit, stabbed him right there, and did not enter his home. And that would explain why Oog's shoe prints weren't outside, because in that theory, that's where the bleeding began. And would also explain why there were no unidentified shoe prints inside, because in that scenario, the killer never went inside his home, which also aligned with his doors being locked. I would presume the back door was already locked when this all happened, and he could have locked the front door right after being attacked outside. So that's why earlier I was saying it actually doesn't matter that much that his doors were locked, because he could have been stabbed outside and locked the door on his way in. Detective Casillas has pointed out that there was no blood trail leading away from Oog's home, as you might expect if he were stabbed inside his home or even outside, like from a killer running away. But to play devil's advocate, if it happened very quickly, maybe blood didn't transfer from Oog to the perpetrator. Dr. Azar told 48 Hours that the pattern of the blood evidence indicated that Oog had slowly walked around his home while bleeding. There was no sign of high velocity blood spatter. The blood stains were circular and well-rounded, which Azar explained indicates Oog was not moving quickly or engaged in a struggle. If he had been running through his home, that would have produced more elongated stains with directional tails. This is all suggestive, though. It doesn't conclusively tell us what happened, but I had been thinking it made sense that he would have been staggering around his home based on what we know about the injuries. With that stab to his neck, like I said before, he only had a minute or two to live after that. Dr. Azar thought it didn't make sense, and coupled with the fact that his cell phone was on the coffee table untouched without any calls to 911, you could use that to bolster a suicide theory. Or you could look at it through the lens that he was moments from dying and didn't have the means to walk around at a fast pace or to call for help. During the 48 Hours coverage, the interviewer asked a question along those lines. She said, quote, "Is it possible from a physiological standpoint that he could have been stabbed, and if he was even in a slightly inebriated state, not have an understanding of what was going on, of how seriously wounded he was?" Dr. Azar responded with, quote, "That doesn't make any sense. I've talked to two surgeons, trauma surgeons. That doesn't make sense to them. You don't walk around in a daze when you've just been attacked. A dying person will call out," end quote. Which feels reductive and like an unusually absolute statement about a person who was bleeding out moments away from death. People respond in different ways to severe trauma. And for all we know, maybe he tried to call out and couldn't, or maybe neighbors couldn't or didn't hear him. Oog's family hired a private investigator, and he commented on this as well. He was told by physicians he spoke with that Oog could have easily been in a state of shock, unable to make a rational decision. You would think Oog's cognitive clarity would have rapidly declined, at least after the stab to his neck that punctured his lung.
I was just thinking he'd just gotten back from the club, had a few drinks. He had just gotten attacked. Maybe he was just looking for his phone. He didn't know where he put it last, and he was walking around as he's losing a significant amount of blood. Maybe he was just looking for his phone and he couldn't find it. And then he collapsed.
That's a really good point. Like, why are they just making the assumption that he knew where his phone was? The idea seems to be that he knew exactly where his phone was, but he was ignoring it. And I think there's an argument to be made that maybe he came into the house and was looking for it. Like you said, I mean, this was 2007. I feel like people weren't as attached to their phones in 2007. And even now, like sometimes I don't know exactly where my phone is at any given moment. I mean, most of the time I know where it is, but we've all just placed it in a random spot around the house before. And if you consider that Oog might have been eating when someone knocked on his door, because recall it, I mean, it looked like he only had a few bites of his meal. Maybe he was in the kitchen. And then when he answered the door, and if that's what happened, right? And someone stabbed him, he comes back in. He maybe didn't know where his phone was. And that could explain why it looked like he kind of tracked all over the living room and kitchen. Granted, that could have just happened anyway, right? Because he only had a little bit of time to live. But I think it's an important point to make that we can't just assume that he knew where his phone was and he was choosing not to use it. Before we get into the dilemma of the missing knife, I want to revisit what the neighbors heard with the added context we have now. So the neighbors heard someone walking around and a big thud, and that makes sense with either possibility, suicide or murder. It's interesting though that no one heard any yelling or talking. If Oog had been attacked, you'd think maybe there'd have been some shouting. But then again, it likely happened pretty quickly. So maybe he didn't even have a chance to say much and he was just worried about defending himself, or the neighbor just didn't hear it. Then the neighbors also heard Oog's door open and close a few times. If they are correct in what they heard, that detail is puzzling to me, and I haven't seen really an explanation for that, whether he died by suicide or was killed by someone.
Yeah, if this was done by another person, I can see the two times of the door opening and closing. Like the first time someone knocks on his door and he opens it and closes it to, you know, he goes outside and sees who it is. And then, you know, the stabbing happens then. And then the second opening and closing is him going back inside, closing it and locking it. The third time is a little more puzzling. If there was a third time, again, this guy was, you know, half asleep. Maybe he misheard and there were only two times, but adding in a third opening and closing of the door makes this a little more puzzling if that is what in fact happened. I mean, maybe the first one is he opens it and closes it to see who it is, and then this person attacks him and he goes back inside and closes the door, and then he's like, wait, I need to try to recognize who this person was that just attacked me, because he probably doesn't realize that has a minute or two to live. Then he opens it and closes it to go try to see who it was. Maybe. I mean, this, now that I'm saying it out loud, it seems kind of ridiculous. Like, you just got attacked, just go inside for safety. But I guess a third one could have happened if someone else stabbed him, but I see it more likely just being the two times.
Yes, I think it's very possible that the neighbor was like, oh, I heard the door open and close a few times, and it was just the two times that you mentioned, and that would make sense with the murder theory. What do you think about the neighbors not hearing any yelling or talking between two people?
If someone went there to kill Oog, I don't think they're going to be outside on the stoop just chatting. So I don't think it's surprising that there was no talking. I do find it a little surprising that Oog didn't shout or yell or shout for help or anything after being attacked, if that's what happened. But yeah, I don't think it's surprising that the neighbor didn't hear any talking. I mean, suppose what would there be to talk about?
Well, I was thinking, to get Oog to even come outside, wouldn't you say something? Or I guess, I don't know. I mean, you could even just say a few words like, is Oog just going to step outside for a random person? Do they have to say something to get him outside? I don't know. But the shouting and yelling, my first thought is like, if someone is attacked like this, their first instinct would be to yell, or like there'd be some commotion. Yeah. But again, it happened so quickly that maybe his focus was just trying to fend this person off with his body and not yelling. I would just love to know, in the murder theory, how the person got Oog to step outside. Maybe Oog just wasn't fearful like I would be in this situation. But he did have a peephole, it appears, from the photos I've seen of their front door. So he could have peered outside and saw someone there. If it was someone familiar, then he would definitely step outside, I would imagine. But maybe he just would have stepped outside for a stranger too. Getting into the missing knife, if someone else stabbed Oog, they clearly took the weapon with them. If Oog stabbed himself, the investigators proposed he either used one of the knives from his home and thoroughly washed it, since there was no bloody knife present, or the other theory put forth was that he threw it out a window or buried it outside somewhere.
Was there any blood trail leading outside to where he would have buried it? I mean, you'd think if he took the time to bury it, there'd be a massive pool of blood. And I mean, in the time that, you know, based on the medical examiner's report, he had 1 to 2 minutes to live. Think it'd probably take that amount of time to bury the knife. If that's the case, he likely would have collapsed outside after he buried the knife.
Yes. Yeah. I tried to stay pretty balanced with these cases, but the notion that he washed it, I have problems with, which I'll explain. But the idea that he buried it is just completely absurd. There was no blood trail leading to anywhere he could have buried it.
Yeah, it seems like a shot in the dark. Like, oh, I don't know, maybe he buried it.
Yeah. So he buried it and then he cleaned up his blood on the way back, all the while having a minute or two to live.
Was there any dirt or mud on his clothes or anything?
No. So there were 3 knives in Oog's home that could have inflicted the wounds he sustained. They were not inconsistent with being the weapon used. Specifically, there was a steak knife among other dishes in Oog's kitchen sink that was of interest. The blade was wet and there was a small amount of red substance on it. So could this have been the knife used?
By the sink, was there a large pool of blood? Because I mean, if he's taking the time to wash the knife and he's losing a ton of blood, you'd think there'd be a large pool right there on the ground in front of the sink.
No.
Or around the sink or anywhere.
Yeah, no, there wasn't. And that's exactly what I was going to point out. There was some blood around the sink, kind of like there was all over his main living area, but not a pool of blood or a concentrated spot, right? The knives were sent for testing. Maybe they could find trace amounts of blood or maybe that red substance was blood. But the results came back and there was not a single trace of blood identified on the knives or in the kitchen sink. The red substance on the knife in the sink was determined to be a tomato stain. So this is a problem because I am willing to accept that a person could stab themselves and then wash the knife. It sounds unusual, very unusual, but unusual scenarios happen. However, we'd have to believe that he managed to clean the knife and the sink so unbelievably well that he didn't leave a single trace of blood in the sink or on the knife, all the while not leaving a pool of blood on the floor by the sink. How is that even possible? How could he not leave at least some blood in the sink? In order to wipe down or rinse out the sink, he had to be standing over it. And there was no blood in the other sinks in the house either. Or there's still the option they allegedly proposed that he hid the knife or threw it out a window. But if he threw it out the window, why didn't they find it? And when you're faced with someone killed him and took the weapon with them or one of these other situations, the latter situations are far harder to believe. And if you can't believe that one of those scenarios they proposed is accurate, then how are you supposed to believe this is a suicide?
Were there any cameras outside or anything that was able to pick up Oog coming home or him coming outside to see potentially if someone knocked on his door or anything like that, or if someone walked up to his door?
There was a security camera on Oog's street. I believe this is a camera on one of Oog's neighbor's buildings, not his direct neighbors, but just another building on the street. That camera picked up the back of a man walking and turning by Oog's home at 2:06 a.m. And when people close to Oog saw this footage, although it was dark and grainy, they believed, based on the silhouette and gait of the person, that this was Oog. Now, because of the angle of the camera, it doesn't show him entering his apartment or even walking up the steps. But the timing made sense too. 2:06 a.m. would have been right around the time he should have gotten home if he walked straight home after leaving the club. The San Francisco police have reported that there was no activity picked up at the time it's believed Oog died, or even within the hours following that time. However, the security camera reportedly did not provide full constant coverage since it was motion activated. So it's possible that when Oog passed the camera, he activated it to record momentarily. If Oog was killed and the person did not walk past the camera and say came from the opposite direction, it's possible they were not close enough to the camera to activate it to record. Initially, when you hear that Oog was picked up on the camera, but no one else was, that seems to point against murder. But again, this was not a foolproof camera. Melissa, Oog's friends and parents were all disappointed in the investigation into Oog's death, firmly believing he was killed by someone. Melissa told 48 Hours that she was the one to notify Oog's parents of his death, and they were devastated by the loss of their only child. Oog's parents, who lived in France, promptly traveled to San Francisco, and when time passed without answers, they hired the private investigator I mentioned earlier. Additionally, a French detective who was based in Los Angeles was enlisted to work on the case. It was reportedly this detective who discovered what Oog was doing online before his death, after he was granted permission from the San Francisco police to bring in computer professionals to dig into that activity several months after Oog's death. They learned that he had been cruising dating and adult websites as well as Craigslist before the activity abruptly stopped at 2:38 a.m. It was disappointing to Oog's family that it had to be this detective who pieced this all together and that the San Francisco PD had not done that work yet. And I don't know if they had planned to. Oog's parents desperately wanted French authorities to investigate their son's death. And it took until 2008, about a year after Oog's death, for their wish to be granted. The French police obtained authorization through a U.S. court order to review the evidence. By the conclusion of their investigation, the French authorities had produced a 2,000-page report with the finding that Oog's death was unequivocally a homicide. The French forensic experts who reviewed the case believed that Oog was attacked outside of his home. According to Oog's dad, who spoke with the investigators, the angles of the entrance wounds were more consistent with someone else having stabbed Oog than Oog stabbing himself, particularly when it came to the wound in the abdomen. The French probe indicated that after being stabbed, Oog was likely in a state of shock, rendering him unable to call for help. Oog's dad shared that French police identified foreign DNA on Oog's watch, the watch that was found broken underneath his body. It's shocking that this could have been missed earlier on in the investigation, but then again, Detective Casillas admitted during his 48 Hours interview that he did not believe all of the pertinent DNA evidence was collected from the scene on the day Oog was found. He said that in hindsight, there was more that could have been done. So it kind of sounds like not only was the scene probably not processed properly, but potentially it was not followed with the appropriate testing of what they did recover. Oog's dad speculated that Oog may have tried to protect himself with his arm and his watch broke when it hit his attacker, got loose, and then came off when he fell to his death.
And I believe you mentioned earlier that he had a bruise on his right arm.
Yes.
So he seems like he could have been defending himself by swinging his arm at this person if he was attacked and got the bruise on his arm and simultaneously broke his watch on this person.
Yeah, and his dad said he did wear his watch on his right wrist. So that, I think, kind of ties together. You can kind of imagine that it's instinctive to put your arm up if someone's stabbing at you. Like, I would imagine your first instinct would be to like block yourself or try to push the person away. And I can see how he would sustain that bruise on his arm. I've not seen any reports though on what kind of testing has been done with that foreign DNA on the watch. So this information was quite interesting because a lot of the early reports specified that there was no foreign DNA at the scene and everything belonged to Oog. But that's not all. Dr. Azar's autopsy report notes that there were approximately 10 curly black hair strands between 1/2 inch and 2 inches long stuck to Oog's left index finger and thumb. They had kind of adhered to or mixed in with the blood on his hand. The San Francisco Examiner reported that these hairs did not belong to Oog.
I mean, it definitely seems like he pulled these out of someone's head or something, right? In an effort to defend himself?
Yeah, this feels huge. In a case with little evidence, this is so significant. The hairs were in his hand. They were not in random spots of his house and like could have been left by various guests over time. And there were 10 of them. That is a significant amount of hair and could indicate that he pulled at someone's hair during a struggle. And what's kind of frustrating about this case is like, if this had just been called a homicide, we'd be like, yeah, that makes sense. He pulled at somebody's hair during a struggle. But because they introduced this possibility of suicide, it complicates it more. But I think in any other case, and I'm going to mention it at the end, but we've covered a similar case to this. If he had had hair in his hand, it would be like, yeah, he probably was pulling at somebody's hair. Ultimately, Detective Casillas told 48 Hours that the French investigation did not materially impact the SFPD's investigation, largely because their position was always that they were investigating the case as a homicide. But Melissa wasn't shy about her feelings that this was deceptive. She believed they were treating it as a suicide while publicly maintaining they were treating it as a homicide. Oog's dad claimed that Detective Casillas said to him that until someone confesses, he'll view it as a suicide, which is probably the last thing you want to hear from the lead investigator and what you believe is your child's homicide. The French authorities were not the only outsiders to be brought in to review Oog's death after the French review. The San Francisco PD police chief, who was new at the time, announced that 2 homicide investigators from the Los Angeles police would look into the case. Their goal was to review the existing evidence and information, not to conduct their own investigation. The investigators concluded that suicide was the most likely explanation. However, the LAPD team also determined that shortcomings in the original investigation, particularly communication failures at the scene that resulted in the loss of potential evidence, prevented a definitive conclusion from being reached. Additionally, the SFPD requested a medical examiner from a neighboring county who used to work for the San Francisco Medical Examiner's Office examine the case. And his opinion was that Oog's death was an unambiguous homicide. He reported this, quote, "Summarizing the sequence of events, I infer from the reviewed evidence is as follows. Mr. De La Plaza returned home from nightclubbing around 2 a.m. and entered his residence. There, he ate some food and apparently made phone calls and utilized his computer. For some reason, he exited his apartment, or at least stepped outside to answer his door. Either upon exiting or at a subsequent return, an assailant who was most likely positioned on the lower landing of the staircase stabbed Mr. De La Plaza while he was on the lower steps. The victim retreated inside the apartment and the assailant most probably did not follow inside. The victim went to the kitchen and returned to the front room, bleeding profusely. At some point, he briefly stopped near the overturned television and entertainment center, where rapidly bleeding resulted in a large volume of blood on the floor. He soon collapsed from hemorrhagic shock in the front room where he was found." End quote. For those who believe this was a homicide, the theory of how this happened usually follows that sequence of events or a similar sequence of events. And with the evidence, it does make the most sense that he would have been attacked outside, as we've already discussed. This medical examiner also noted blood spatter on the wall outside of Oog's home that was consistent with cast off from the arm movements of a knife being plunged and removed from Oog. as an outsider looking at this case, it didn't appear that any of these conclusions affected the San Francisco PD's position or their direction with the case. Those closest to Oog, but also just people in his community, have been disgusted by what they deem either incompetence on the part of the police department or something worse, a deliberate attempt to reduce the city's homicide statistics. The SFPD made arrests, charged, and turned over criminals to prosecution in only about 25% of 98 homicide cases in 2007, the year Oog died. Oog is not included in any of the homicide stats due to his manner of death being classified as undetermined. It certainly didn't help matters when it came out that Detective Casillas and Dr. Azar had been engaged in a romantic affair. And I believe they were actively engaged in this affair at the time of Oog's death. If they were, that immediately undermines the credibility of their findings. Dr. Azar has maintained that she doesn't know if Oog died by suicide or was killed. She pointed out that there seemed to be no motive. It didn't seem to be a robbery. Oog still had cash in his pocket and credit cards. Nothing appeared to be stolen. To which I say, why is she, as the medical examiner, weighing in on potential motive? She doesn't need to know what motive someone may have had to kill Oog to do her job. Oog's loved ones believe there are multiple possible explanations for his death. Oog lived in a nice area, but some have said his walk home from the club would have taken him through some undesirable areas. Someone could have spotted Oog on his way home, followed him, knocked on his door to get him to come out so they could kill him, making this a completely random crime. Why? We don't know. Something that I like to know is if someone were to make some sort of off-color remark to Oog as he walked home, how would he usually respond? Would he snap back? Could he have gotten into a verbal altercation with someone on his way home that was brief, and maybe that person was unstable? And that's what led to this. I mean, I just think Oog could have had a brief interaction with someone on that walk home that led up to this that we know nothing about. He didn't mention that on the phone with his friend when he got home, but he could have just let it roll off his back. And by the time he got home, he'd nearly forgotten about it. On the other hand, Melissa has thrown out kind of two different possibilities. One related to his dating patterns. She said he wasn't always cautious about who he was seeing. Could someone have found out that Oog got with their partner and wanted revenge? The private investigator who worked on Oog's case told 48 Hours that he didn't find evidence of this, but it doesn't mean it's not possible. The other possibility Melissa has suggested relates to Oog's occasional drug use. She wondered if he stiffed the wrong dealer. Oog's dad has made it clear that he believes Oog knew his killer and that person was either an acquaintance or a friend. These aren't bad theories. They just can't be proven at this time, but this case still sits with the SFPD, who I don't imagine is spending a lot of time on it anymore.
Yeah, I don't think during this episode I've been tiptoeing around what I actually think happened. I think, like I said before, the notion of suicide is kind of far-fetched.
It's not evidence-backed.
Yeah. But the theory that the French investigators put forth was, I think that has to be the most legitimate option. It makes the most sense. You know, no knife, no weapon found at the scene. Someone could have attacked him from outside and fled immediately. And then he goes back inside and wanders around, stumbling and eventually collapsing.
I mean, what are your thoughts on the type of person who would do this or the type of scenario that could have led to this with Oog?
Yeah, I suppose I see a couple avenues here. You know, where he lived was fine, but getting home from, you know, the surrounding areas were a little dicey. So I could see a situation where, yeah, maybe he got into an altercation and eventually made it home, but maybe someone followed him and, you know, everything else unfolded the way it did. Or, yeah, maybe his dating patterns, for lack of a better word, maybe the partner or husband or boyfriend of someone that he was involved with found out and took it upon themselves to do this to Oog.
I've even seen some people suggest that someone he dated did this to him. They felt scorned, right? I don't know how likely that is. We don't know how likely any of these theories are, right? But I do think if, like, it makes more sense that he would step outside to someone he knows or is familiar with. But then again, I don't think it's that unlikely that he would go outside to someone he didn't know or couldn't even see. Like, if he looked at his people, maybe he heard a knock, but couldn't see whoever knocked at the door. But on the other hand, if someone completely random did this to him, who he had no connection with, then that could make this a lot harder to solve. So that could explain why it's not solved. But I actually think the real explanation for why it's not solved, or at least a significant reason why, would be how they've handled the investigation. And yeah, they're saying they're looking at it as a homicide, but from what many other people are saying who have looked at this, it doesn't appear that way. When researching this case, I couldn't help but think of the murder of Stephen Spina. We covered his case last year, and it was our 84th episode. Stephen lived in an apartment, and he was found stabbed multiple times in the entryway of his apartment. When he was discovered, his door was locked, and there was no bloody knife in his home, just like Oog. They were even both stabbed on the left side of their body, which in that case indicated to the police that the killer was most likely right-handed. I find it so interesting that suicide didn't come up once in that case, and the medical examiner had no difficulty labeling it a homicide. It's just interesting to compare these two cases and the different outcomes and how they were approached. At one point, Oog's family offered a $100,000 reward generated from his life insurance payout for information leading to an arrest in this case. It's unclear if that reward is still available, but I wanted to share that in case it is. If you have information related to this case, please call the San Francisco Police Department's anonymous tip line at 415-575-4444. Thank you all so much for listening to our 100th episode. That's all for now, but we will be back in 2 weeks with a new case. Bye.
Bye.